Again, it's a really wonderful meeting. So my topic is going to be entirely different from the mini course that I gave earlier. So this is joint work with Oded Schramm and David Wilson. So of course Oded Schramm was perhaps the leading figure of his generation in probability theory. He passed away in a tragic accident, hiking accident, in 2008, and I had the privilege to work with him on this project, which of course was one of the many, many things that he was involved with. And given that it was Oded, it's no surprise that quite a lot of papers with his name on have come out since he passed away, and this is one of them. This one kind of took us an embarrassingly long time to finish it, but now it's out and finished. So what is it all about? So I want to talk about colouring, proper colouring of a graph. So you take a graph, a nice graph, maybe Z2, and you have a fixed number of colours, which are simply integers 1 up to q, as far as I'm concerned. And a colouring is a map that assigns a colour to each vertex so that adjacent vertices have distinct colours. Okay, so, can you give a proper colouring of Z2? Yes, of course you can. For instance, you only need two colours, and then you can colour with in a checkerboard fashion like this. So the question I want to get at, though, is can we properly colour a graph with no central authority? I mean, imagine that somehow the vertices are individual agents. There's no dictator telling them what to do, but they have to come up with colours themselves somehow. And we'll figure out what the somehow means, so that it's a proper colouring. Okay, well, I mean, to begin with, if we're talking about Z2 is a transitive graph, vertex transitive, so all the vertices look the same locally. So whatever it means to colour with no central authority, it seems like it should be the same rules everywhere, because vertices are indistinguishable locally. Every vertex is in the same position somehow. Okay, it makes sense to think about stationary random colouring. So we want to choose a random colouring of the whole graph, which is stationary, invariant under translations, say, in distribution. Maybe invariant under other symmetries as well. But, so that's a natural thing to think about. Is there a stationary proper colouring of Z2? Well, yes, of course there is. You can still do it with two colours. So deterministically, there are precisely two colourings of Z2, of course. There's the checkerboard like this, and there's the other checkerboard. And if you want a stationary random colouring, then of course the only thing you can do is take that checkerboard with probability half and that checkerboard with probability half. That's a stationary process. But of course, whatever my question about no central authority means, this is a failure at answering that question, because this random colouring has as long range correlation as you can possibly have. If I tell you the colour of the origin, if I tell you the origin is red, then that tells you everything. So that's not what I'm aiming for at all. So what am I aiming for? Well, really, I want some kind of asymptotic independence. I mean, this is the opposite of independence. If I know one colour, then I know everything. Everything is as correlated as it can be. On the other hand, of course, it's impossible to have each vertex choose its own colour independently. It's impossible for the colours to be IID, because then it won't be a proper colouring if you have a finite number of colours. But what about approximate independence? So can I think about stationary processes, which are colourings with probability 1, which have some sort of approximate independence between faraway vertices? And of course there are many, many notions of approximate independence. Much of probability theory is centered around exploring such notions. There are trivial tails, there are all sorts of decay of correlation conditions, there's all sorts of mixing conditions. So there are many things you could ask, but I'm going to ask a very specific question, which I believe is particularly natural given my motivation. So, and this is very close to some things we've already heard about in this meeting, so that's good. So a process, so it's just a process indexed by, let's say, ZD, is called a finitary factor of an IID process if the following conditions hold. So it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's very, very intuitive. So condition one, all the randomness comes from an IID process. So you have some IID process indexed by the vertices, taking values in whatever space you want, but each vertex just has this random variable in the IID. And X, the entire process X, is a deterministic function of those U's. And it's a translation equivariant function of them, which means it looks the same everywhere. So, you know, I choose all my IID labels, I do something to come up with the X's. If I were to shift all the U labels to the right by one, then I would end up with the X's all shifted to the right by one. So that's very, very natural. It's a deterministic function. X is a deterministic function of U, and it's a function that, if you like, commutes with translations, but just think of it as it looks the same everywhere. And, well, the interesting condition is that F, this map, is finitary. Finitary, if you like, means almost everywhere continuous in an appropriate sense, but here's what it means concretely. It means if you are sitting at the origin and you want to determine what the color at the origin is, x0, well, it is a function of all the u's, but it's kind of a finite range function, kind of, because the range is random. So the statement is the color at the origin is determined by the u's within some box of size r, where r is random. It can depend on the u's. So it's kind of like a stopping time. You can think of it, I mean, that was the definition, but here's one way you can think of it. Here's part of the definition. I mean, what does it really mean? There's some R that depends on the U's, such that if the U's agree on the box, then they assign the same color to the origin. But you should think of it as there is an algorithm for determining what color to put at the origin, and the algorithm is of the form, you look at the IID label at the origin, see what it is, and then depending on what you see, maybe you look at the neighbors of the origin, look at their U's, and then again, depending on what you see, maybe you look at the next nearest neighbors, and so on. But with probability one, at some point you know, this algorithm finishes and you know what color to put at the origin. But maybe it's a random distance. Yeah?
Is it the same as almost everywhere continuous?
Yeah, I think so. You have to decide what your metric is, but yeah. And this radius is called, this R, it's a random variable, it's called the Kodak radius. Okay, so again, it's this stopping time-like algorithm for determining the color based on the U's, and every vertex uses the same algorithm, of course, local to its own U's and its neighborhood. Okay, that's the definition, and that's what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk, so if anything's unclear here, please do ask. And I'll give lots of examples, of course. So here's the question. Does there exist an FFIID, finitary factor of IID, that was what I just defined, colouring? A process that is FFIID and is almost surely a colouring. And, okay, well, the nice thing is, that's just a yes-no question for each graph and each number of colours, but then we can ask a quantitative question as well. We can ask, how small can we make this random variable, the coding radius, which tells you how far you have to look to determine your colour. Okay, so some trivial things. Let's look at ZD. I'm going to look at ZD. With two colours, the answer is no, because, again, the only stationary colouring is this checkerboard that's with probability half one checkerboard, with probability half the other, and it's pretty straightforward, I won't do it, to show that cannot be expressed as an FFIID process. Can't even be expressed as just a factor of IID, a translation equivalent function of IID variables. And of course, at the other extreme, if you try to make the coding radius zero, then that's just saying that you have an IID process. You don't look at the other U's at all, you just look at your own random variable, and of course that's impossible. If you care, these kind of questions do have applications in computer science, in distributed computing. So imagine you have some network of machines, computers, and distributed computing is about trying to do computations with networks without any central authority. Somehow the computation goes on locally. But colouring is just asking a very simple question. Can these computers reach a consensus so at least they're not conflicting with each other? So you can imagine that colours represent communication frequencies or update schedules, and adjacent pairs of machines shouldn't be in conflict with each other. So they have to choose different communication frequencies. That's a colouring. Can they choose their colours locally by picking their own randomness and then communicating with each other? And if so, how far do they have to communicate? So here's an example. So the answer is, at least in some circumstances, yes, you can perform this task. So I will give you a simple example of a finitely factory of IID for colouring of Z2. And furthermore, the coding radius will have exponential tails. Okay, so there's a very simple way to do this. So, first of all, label each vertex of Z2. So, for some reason, now my vertices have become the squares rather than the interstices, either black or white, with probability half IID. So of course this is not a proper colouring. I can easily have two black squares next to each other. Percolation theory tells you that the critical probability for site percolation on Z2 is strictly bigger than a half. So a half is subcritical. So what that means is that you have these white clusters and black clusters, but they're finite, as the new subgraphs of Z2. And more than that, they're sort of very finite. The diameter, the cluster at the origin, which may be a white or a black cluster, has exponential tails on its diameter. I have four colours, so now what I'm going to do is, in each white cluster, I'm going to choose a checkerboard using red and blue, and in each black cluster, I'm going to... these are the white clusters, and then in each black cluster, I'm going to checkerboard in green and yellow. Okay, and I have to be a little bit careful because I have to remember there are two phases of checkerboard. I mean, there are two types of red-blue checkerboards. That was the whole obstacle before. So I have to decide which one on each cluster. I mean, and one way to do that is you can just start from the northeast corner. Here's a white cluster, and you define the northeast corner of it by lexicographic order on Z2, and you say that one's going to be red. What?
But how does the point know it's in the northeast corner?
Okay, yeah, good. So, I mean, this is a description of a process, and so why is it FFIID? The randomness is just these black-white coin flips. Each vertex flips a coin. And now, if I'm sitting at the origin, I want to know what color I should be, so I explore my cluster. I see what color I am, black or white, and I look at my neighbors and so on, explore the percolation cluster. It's finite, and so I have to look at the cluster itself, and I have to look at its boundary, basically. But, I mean, you can just do it by rectangles if you want, or you can actually explore the cluster vertex by vertex. So at some point I find out what my cluster is, and then I look at the northeast corner of it. I mean, I know what the cluster is now, and that's going to be red, and so I see whether I'm the same parity as the northeast corner in my cluster or not. That tells me whether I'm red or blue. Okay, so that's a finitely factor of an IID process, and of course, because the clusters have exponential tails, the distance that I have to look to has exponential tails. I have to look the diameter of my cluster, maybe plus one, because I have to look to the boundary. Is it clear? Now, you might not like this northeast corner very much, and I would I would sympathize with that, because, I mean, my definition was my map has to be equivariant under translations, and this is equivariant under translations, but you could ask that to be equivariant under all symmetries of Z2. That's very reasonable. Reflections and rotations as well. Could I do that? Well, yeah, there's an easy way to do that as well. So in addition to doing this black-white coin flip for each vertex, I will also choose a uniform 0-1 random variable at each vertex, IID, independent of everything else. And now my underlying randomness is the coin flips together with these ones, of course. And then I do the clusters again, and instead of looking at the northeast corner, I look at the vertex of my cluster that has the largest U, say, in the cluster, and make him red, say, if it's a white cluster. Okay, so then it's also F of ID, same sort of tails, and now it's even invariant under rotations and so on. Okay, so that wasn't too hard once we understood the definitions. So, of course, the question is, can we do better? So exponential tails is already pretty good, but is there any reason why R couldn't be bounded? I mean, maybe if I have 20 colors available or something, maybe I can just look to distance 10 and determine my color to get a proper coloring. Not so clear. What about other dimensions, 3 dimensions and so on, and what about other numbers of colors? Of course, more colors makes your life easier. So can you do 3 colors? Okay, so it turns out we know pretty much all the answers to these questions, on ZD at least. Let's look at ZD in 2 or more dimensions. There, you can do 3 colors. So we know you can't do 2 colors. You can do 3 colors. There exists an FFIID coloring, but not with exponential tail, but with power law tail. The probability that you have to look to distance R decays like a power of R. And you cannot do better than a power law tail in the sense that any FFIID coloring has infinite second moment. And there's a gap here. The A that we can prove in this power is something very, very small but positive, so we don't know what the truth is between 2 and something very small. But that's true for every dimension greater than or equal to 2. Okay, so with 4 colors, can you do better than exponential? Well, it turns out you can. And this is pretty surprising. So you cannot do bounded coding radius, but you can get very, very close to it in a certain sense. You can get better than exponential, better than double exponential, you can get a tower function. So the probability that you have to look to distance R, so there exists a 4-coloring, so the probability you have to look to distance R decays like 1 over a tower of exponentials of height about R. And that's tight. I mean, up to the constants and so on, which, of course, constants matter quite a lot in functions like this. And that's tight even for any number of colors. So even if you have 20 colors, you can't do better than a tower function decay like this. And all that was 2 or more dimensions. 1 dimension is slightly different. Yeah, of course, all these constants depend on D and Q. 1 dimension, you don't have this power law phase for 3 coloring. You just have tower behavior for 3 or more colors. Okay, so let me try to prove some of these things. Here's the maybe the simplest one. Here is a way to 3-color Z2 with power law tails. So first of all, think about a unit square of Z2. You only have 3 colors, and you have 4 vertices, so there must be 2 colors the same in the square, and so it must be that one diagonal pair are the same color. And maybe both diagonals are the same color as each other. So I'm sort of going to use that as motivation. I'm going to, for each unit square, I'm going to choose with fair coin flips to draw a diagonal that way or that way. Not both, just one. Okay, so, well, this is actually a familiar picture. If you look at the even sublattice of Z2, which is these green vertices, and look at the graph that's induced by these diagonals, it's simply critical bond percolation. It's bond percolation on a lattice twisted, on a square lattice twisted to 45 degrees, and with P equals a half, which is the critical point for bond percolation on Z2. So these green clusters, again, the clusters that are formed by these diagonals on the even sublattice are finite, but they're quite big. They have power law tails. And what about the purple diagonals, the ones on the odd sublattice? Well, those are precisely the planar dual of the green percolation configuration. It's also a critical bond percolation. And somehow, you know, I have to remember the lesson of slide one. If I'm to produce a finite refractory IOD colouring, I have to treat the odd and even sublattices the same. I can't say, okay, now I'm going to do something clever on the even sublattice and then figure out the odd sublattice. I have to sort of treat them the same. Okay, they're a nice property. So each green cluster, like here's a finite green cluster, is surrounded by some purple cluster. In this case, it's sort of this one, and vice versa. I mean, these are just geometric properties of combinatorial properties of planar percolation and its dual. So each cluster of one lattice is surrounded by precisely one other cluster. So we'll assign, each cluster a colour, one of the three colours. And of course, what we have to do is we have to make sure that two adjacent clusters get different colours. That's all I have to do to get a colour. What is the adjacency graph of clusters? Well, each cluster is surrounded by another cluster, exactly one, so it has a parent. And so you have a tree of clusters. Each one is surrounded by precisely one, so you have a one-ended tree. Going down, everything stops, but going up, there's an infinite line of ancestry. So it's just a tree, so I have to three-colour a tree. Well, that doesn't sound too hard, because, of course, a tree is two-colourable, so if I have three colours, I sort of have a lot of freedom, so hopefully I can do it in a nice local way. So here's one way to do it. So first of all, just colour each vertex of the tree, which remember is a cluster in this percolation picture, red with probability half. Okay, so that's not going to work because I may have two adjacent things that are red. But now I'm going to, anything that's red and its parent is also red, I delete the red. So now I have some red vertices that are separated from each other. No two are next to each other. And now, I have two more colours to play with, so I'm just going to fill in layers. So below a red, I make its children blue, and then the grandchildren green, and so on, and until I run into another red, and then I sort of start again from there. Many, many ways to do it. So this is a three colouring of the tree. And on the tree, it's local. I mean, it's FFIAD with good exponential tails, because if I want to know my colour, I only have to go up my ancestry line until I meet a red vertex, and that has exponential decay because of the way I chose the red vertices. So on the tree, it has exponential decay, and the vertices of the tree are percolation clusters which had power law decay. So it sounds good. Sounds like it should be a power law. And you still have to prove that. The only way I really know to do that is using Rousseau Seymour Welsh type bounds, which says in percolation, if you take an annulus, there's some positive, an annulus of sort of fixed aspect ratio, fixed shape, there's a positive probability of having a circuit in it of either type. So it's using that, you can bound how far you need to look to find the red cluster in your ancestral line, and so you get a power law, and because it comes from this Rousseau Seymour Welsh type bound, unfortunately the power is pretty bad, so I don't know whether it can be improved. But that's that. So Z2, three colouring Z2 with power law tails. Now we can do this on ZD. And it's the same sort of idea, but it's more complicated. So, first of all, we construct a hierarchical partition of ZD that has the same kind of tree structure as these clusters that I had. And so it's a partition of ZD into tiles, such that each tile is surrounded by exactly one parent, essentially, and the whole structure is a one-ended tree. So you have a parent and a grandparent and so on, and each tile is finite. And you can do this as an FFIID process with power law tails. So you have to work a little bit. We have some process of choosing random seeds and then drawing balls around seeds of carefully chosen sizes and amalgamating balls. It's a bit messy and technical. What? No, it's not a percolation argument. It's a random seeds argument. Random seeds of various orders. It's a bit messy, but we can do this. Now, something's a bit different here, though, because these tiles, before the tiles were these diagonal clusters, so I could assign each cluster its own color. Here I can't do this. The tiles are, you know, actual solid blobs, so they contain adjacent vertices themselves, so I can't assign each tile a color, but what I can do is assign each tile a checkerboard. And with three colors, there are sort of six possible checkerboards, red, green, blue, etc. So one of these is going to get pasted onto each tile, and you see some pairs of them can go adjacent to each other, like this can go adjacent to this because the red is in the same place and the blue is changed into green, and the graph of possible adjacencies is just a hexagon in this case. So again, it's sort of the same idea. You look at this tree of tiles, and again, each tile is surrounded by another. You choose some special vertices by similar sort of methods to what I did before. You have to make sure that the height difference between special vertices is at least the diameter of this graph. And each special cell chooses a checkerboard. So you think of this sort of hierarchy. There's some Archduke here who decides what his favorite checkerboard is. It's red green, and he's going to try and force all his subjects, everyone below him, to use that. But he can't quite do that because there's some king or emperor above him who has told him that his color has to be this. But he tries his best to make all his descendants use green red, and he has to work towards it from his own checkerboard that he was given. And you know, this takes maybe three steps to do it because that's the diameter of the graph. So he works towards it, but then, you know, whenever you have another special vertex, it gets to take over. It has its own favorite checkerboard and it tries to force its descendants to do that. So it's an argument that's inspired by the other one. Okay, so that was three coloring ZD. And this is quite a general argument. You could do this on other lattices, and the number of colors depends on local properties of the lattice. There. Yeah.
A general question. You don't seem to be talking about how much time this is going to take. Is the whole parameter of the capital R?
Well, I'm not really thinking about computational complexity, if that's what you mean. I'm not really thinking about that, although, I mean, I think all the things I'm talking about here, the computational complexity for a single vertex would be similar to the volume of the ball of red as well, but we're not focusing on that. Okay, so what about a lower bound? So, again, I'll be a little bit vague here, but I'll tell you what the basic idea is. So I claimed on ZD any three coloring has infinite moment of the R, infinite second moment of the R, any FFIID three coloring, and it's enough to prove that in Z2 actually, because if you tell me you've got a super good three coloring of Z3 that you can choose as a function of IID random variables on Z3, well, in particular, you're coloring the plane, Z2, because that's part of Z3, and, well, I can just think of the whole column of IID random variables that goes through a point of Z2 as a single random variable. I mean, they're still IID on different columns, and so you've also colored Z2 in a similarly good way. So it's enough to prove it for Z2. And in fact, something much stronger is true. So any stationary three colouring of Z2 has some lower bound on the decay of correlations, which translates into this infinite second moment when you translate it back. So the key fact here is that there is a height function for three colourings of Z2. So if you have a three colouring of Z2, think of the colours as 0, 1 and 2, then corresponding to it there is a height function, which means there is an integer assigned to each site, and adjacent sites the integer differs by exactly 1, plus or minus 1, and the way you can get it is the height is equal to the colour modulo 3. And when you go along an edge, well, you can think of the colour as either going up by 1 modulo 3 or going down by 1 modulo 3 because it's a different colour, and so there's a unique way to continue. So once you choose one height, you determine them all. And the point is, because it's a height function, if you go around any contour, even a very big contour, the total height change must be zero. And that's somehow, intuitively at least, that's incompatible with having very strong decay of correlations, right? Because if everything is sort of local, everything's myopic, then as you go around this contour, well, the height is just going to fluctuate up and down. I mean, no one has any long-range communication with anyone else, so when you join back up again, it seems very unlikely that the total height change would be zero. There's just no reason why it should. And so that's, we just formalize that argument. Maybe I won't go into all the details, but suppose you have a process which has just very good decay of correlation somehow. That in particular implies that it's a tail trivial process, and that implies that the variance, so take a big square, this implies that the variance of the height change along a side of the square is large. It goes to infinity, or at least it doesn't go to zero. And what we use here is this interesting lemma. So I just put it up because some people are interested in things like this. I'd be interested if anyone's seen this before. It's not super hard, but not super easy to prove, and it's kind of an interesting lemma. If you have a plus one valued stationary sequence of random variables, if it's right tail trivial and not deterministic, then you look at the sum of the first n of them, and you look at the variance of that, then the limb sup of that is infinity almost surely. So that's what's at the heart of this. And then, also, if you have some fast decay...
You're almost sure of here, right? Variance is another.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, there should not be an almost surely there. Thank you. Yes, variance is a number. also it turns out with the right fast decay of correlations condition, the changes along the four sides of this square are approximately independent. So you get indeed that it's unlikely that the height change will join up. That's the idea. All this can be formalized. Okay, so let's go to the other side of things, this mysterious tower function. So let's even just colour Z with some finite number of colours with a tower function decay, with a tower function tail of the coding radius. So the essential idea here is this very nice and interesting idea, which comes originally from computer science. It comes from a paper by Cole and Vishkin. So we're on Z. Suppose you have a labelling of Z with 2 to the n colours. It's not necessarily a proper colouring, it's just a labelling. And there's a way of reducing to far smaller number of colours, to n plus 1, which goes as follows. So here I just have some sequence of numbers along the top, and I write them in binary. 2 is 0, 1, 0, etc. And then here's what I do. I look at adjacent pairs. So for any adjacent pair, if they're equal, like this, 5 and 5, I just write some symbol star that means they're equal. If they're not equal, like these two, I look down the binary expansions until I find a bit that's different. So this is 1 and 1, so those are the same, so that's no good. I go down, and now I find 1 and 0 are different from each other. So that if the two numbers are different, there must be a first place where the bits are different. And I write down greater to mean that the 1 is on the left and the 0 is on the right, and 2 to mean that it was the second bit was different. The second bit was the first one that was different. Okay, so I just do this for every adjacent pair. What's the point of this? The point is, I mean, I've reduced from 2 to the n labels to about 2 n labels down here, 2 n plus 1, and you get a color clash. I mean, I'm trying to produce proper coloring, right? You get two adjacent things with the same label down here, only where you had a color clash in the original sequence. So why is that? If two of these green labels are the same, adjacent to each other, the only way that can happen is if they're both star. Because otherwise it says, okay, you look down and here's the first time that these two bits differ and here's the first time these two bits differ and these two are 1, 0 and these two are 1, 0, and that can't be because the one in the middle can't be both 1 and 0. What's the power of this? Now start from an IID, a discrete IID sequence of numbers with some huge number of integers up to some huge number. So the probability of a color clash is very, very small because I start with IID on some huge finite space, IID uniform on some huge finite space. And I do this reduction a bunch of times until I get down to some small number. And each time I'm reducing the number of labels sort of logarithmically. So locally, the probability of a color clash is essentially the same as it was at the beginning. So it's still very, very small. And on the other hand, what am I doing? Well, I mean, if I want to find the final label at a particular place, it depends locally on the original labels. I mean, it's however many steps I did, k, that's how far I need to look to determine my label. Okay, so, I mean, putting all this together, you get not a colouring, but you get an FFIID process with bounded radius. R is just about k, and the probability of a colour clash is tiny. It's 1 over a tower of k, basically. And you can do this down to something like 6 colours, which is how, I mean, eventually 2n plus 1 is not smaller than 2 to the n, so you can go down until that happens. Okay, so that's not quite it. This is an almost colouring. And so now the idea is, I won't go into quite how you do this, but the idea is you can stitch together these almost colourings for different k. I mean, you try doing it for k steps of this reduction, and occasionally you'll get colour clashes. You'll get two stars next to each other. When you see two stars next to each other, you sort of locally start again, and you go to k plus 1 levels of this procedure. So almost certainly you'll eliminate the colour clash. And then you have to be a bit careful, right? I mean, you have to make sure that these colours don't conflict with the adjacent ones, but you can do that. You can just add some more colours, for example. There are various ways to do that. At the end of the day, it will give you, for example, a 7 colouring of Z with FFIID with tower function tails. And then, for example, it's very easy to get a 7 to the D colouring of ZD. I mean, you just do this in each vertical line and each horizontal line and so on separately and combine the colours. But I claimed 4 colours. Well, you can. There's an easy way to reduce the number of colours to the degree plus 1. So on Z, that would reduce it to 3 colours. Here's a 7 colouring. Now I'm going to eliminate all the 7s. So whenever I see a 7, I'm going to replace it with something else. What do I replace it with? I replace it with the smallest number that's not one of its two neighbours in the colouring. So then it'll still be occurring. So now I've eliminated all the sevens at the cost of just looking perhaps one step further in my coding radius. So that's good news. And then I can do the same thing with the sixes and so on. And I can do this all the way down until I have only three colors and then can't do it anymore. In general, degree plus one. So then we have to get down to four colors. And this, again, this is a sort of complicated argument, which I won't go into many details of. We sweated on this. But the idea is we use these colorings that I just constructed now, and then we use long-range colorings, so not just colorings of ZD, but colorings such that you're not the same color as anybody else with the distance 100 of you, something like this, and various local modifications like this. So finitary factors where the radius is just bounded, and eventually we can come up with a two labeling of ZD, so black and white clusters, where the clusters are bounded. Each cluster just has size at most 1,000, diameter at most 1,000 or something, and then we can checkerboard each cluster, just this trivial thing that I did at the beginning. And somehow it all, eventually, it's very, very complicated, but it all sort of comes down to the fact that in Z2, or even ZD, you can have two things meeting at a corner like this. So the two blacks separate the two whites, but without touching them, each other. It's pretty complicated, but that's how it goes. Okay, what about the lower bound? So, Again, this comes down to, well, this is one of these things where it's difficult to know quite whom to attribute it to, actually. There is a result that's essentially equivalent to this one, again, in the computer science literature, motivated by this, the computer science take on this distributed coloring problem, due to Moni Noor. But arguably, you can see this as a version of Ramsey's theorem, really, a variant of Ramsey's theorem. Anyway, what is it? So, completely clean statement here. Take IID random variables, UI, any distribution you want, maybe a continuous distribution in particular, and suppose you have a function of R arguments, R real arguments, to a finite set. Let's say the set of integers 1 up to Q, doesn't matter. Look at F of U1 up to UR, that's a random thing, and look at shift along by 1, look at U2 up to UR plus 1, and ask whether those two are equal. So the claim is they are equal with positive probability for every Q and for every R. And it's not at all obvious to me, this statement, but it's a fact. And actually, not only is it positive probability, there's a lower bound. There kind of has to be, right? I mean, and the lower bound is something like this, a tower function. Can be very, very small. It can be a tower of height R, and you have a Q at the top, and this is essentially tight. There are examples essentially similar to this binary reduction I showed you, where this is the form of it. And maybe I could try to prove this to you. This is our proof, which I think is kind of cleaner than the previous one. I'll just prove that this probability is positive. Okay, it's by induction. It's by induction on R, which is the length of this block, the number of arguments in the function. R equals 1 is easy because I just have F of U1 equal to F of U2, and those are IID random variables that take values in this discrete space, 1 up to Q. So no problem there. Induction on R, here's the key step. I have my function. I'm going to define a set-valued function of R minus 1 arguments. And the set is, you fix the first R minus 1 arguments of the function to be these inputs, and then you let the last argument of the function be random according to the distribution of these U's. And you see, you ask, what values could this F of these things take? In other words, which values does it take with positive probability? This is the only thing that's random, remember? So that's a set. It's a set-valued function of these R minus 1 numbers, and it only takes finitely many values because it says the F itself takes Q values, so this takes 2 to the Q possible values at most. So I'm going to apply the induction to that. this set-valued function. Induction says with positive probability, when I look at everything's random, the block of length r minus 1 might be equal to this block with positive probability, this s. So that's the same as saying, well, with positive probability there's a deterministic set A such that they're both equal to that. And furthermore, I can just take... suppose this event happens. I mean, all these U's are random, but suppose this event happens. So now look at U, f of U1 up to UR. So sort of by definition, this with probability 1, it lies in that set. So in particular, I can take a deterministic element of that set so that everything here happens with positive probability, that f equals a. But now I haven't looked at UR plus 1 yet. And this is just a completely new independent random variable. So when I look at f of u2 up to u r plus 1, by definition, a is the set of values that can take. So any particular value, like this little a, has a positive probability of being hit. So that's it. And now you could see where the tower function bound might come from, because I'm doing induction on r, and in the inductive step I go from q to 2 to the q. So do this a bit more carefully, you get the tower function bound. So is it clear, why that implies what I want? So if you're on Z, you have a colouring, you have an FFIAD colouring on Z. Well, let's just look at the places where you didn't look to more than distance 100 to determine your colour, and so that gives you an almost colouring. You see what this bound tells you, and it tells you a bound on the coding radius. Okay, so a couple of little extensions, and then I'll stop. So colouring is one choice of local constraint, and there are other choices of local constraint. So the technical term is shifts of finite type. This is a term from ergodic theory. So what's a shift of finite type? It's just a system of local constraints. So let's say we're on ZD, and again, you have Q colors or labels. So you have a configuration on ZD where each vertex has a color. And the rule is that if I look at a K by K box in ZD, I fix K and I have some dictionary of allowed patterns of colors that I'm allowed to see on a K by K box. So I have a list of possible colorings of a 10 by 10 box, and I say wherever you put a 10 by 10 box, you have to see one of those allowed colorings. So that's just a system of local constraints. So of course, colouring is an example of that, because it just says two neighbours have to be different. Well, you can ask what happens for other shifts of finite type. In general, we don't know the answer, but in one dimension, we do know the answer. So on Z, you give me any shift of finite type. You tell me you're allowed to use 10 colors and sequences of length 5 have to be one of these list of possible colorings. And my task is to produce an FFIAD process that satisfies it, almost surely. So there are three possibilities, depending on what system of constraints you hand me. Whoops. 1 and 3 are trivial in different directions. So 3 is the most trivial. If there is some constant sequence, like colour all the integers red, that satisfies your constraints, then my task is done. I mean, I don't even need any randomness, so my R is 0. That's trivial. On the other hand, there's a kind of periodicity obstruction, which is analogous to what happens with 2 colouring. There's some periodicity built into it, so which implies that you cannot even satisfy it as a factor of IID. I mean, there's a definition, but I won't say what it is. And as long as neither of those two hold, then it's like 3 colouring. So the answer is a tower function. You can do a tower function, and you can't beat another tower function. So open question. In shifts of finite type in high dimensions are complicated and wild things, but nevertheless you can ask the question. If you give me a shift of finite type in two or more dimensions, we know, so what's the best FFIAD thing that satisfies it? So we know examples in four categories, the two trivial ones at the ends, and we know power law examples such as three colouring, we know tower law examples such as four colouring. So there are three gaps in between, so are any of them possible? So is there a shift of finite type where the best thing you can do has exponential tails, for example? We don't know. Finally, one more thing. So this tower function bound that I told you, which applied regardless of the number of colours, and even in one dimension, tells you in particular, R cannot be bounded. So in other words, there is no block factor colouring. Block factor means you just have IID random variables, and your colour at the origin is a function of 10 of them, or k of them. So there's no block factor colouring, that's a consequence of what I said. Now, you could try to extend in a different direction. This is impossible, but you could relax in a different direction and see if it's possible. Well, here's such a direction. A stationary process is called k-dependent if things that are at distance k are independent of each other. So, in particular, everything that's to the left of -1 is independent of everything that's to the right of k. So, a block factor process is stationary and k-dependent. I guess k minus 1 dependent. There's a question that goes back actually a long time to the earliest reference to it I know is a book by Ibrahimov and Linick in 1965. Is this if and only if? Are there k-dependent stationary processes that don't arise as block factors? And they proved the answer is no for Gaussian processes, but then this was an open problem for quite a while. Eventually, this bunch of people proved that the answer is no. So there are counterexamples, but you have to work quite hard to produce them. They're quite strange. And there's a bunch of papers where people tried to come up with somehow better counterexamples, but in a sense, all the examples people came up with have the feeling of counterexamples constructed for the purpose. So there's a sort of long-standing informal question, are there any natural counterexamples to this question? And it turns out colouring provides an answer. So colouring, remember, cannot be done by a block factor, but it turns out it can be done by a k-dependent process. So in fact, this is a whole another talk and paper, which I'm not going to do, but there is a stationary one-dependent four-colouring of Z. And there's no one-dependent three-colouring, and there is a two-dependent three-colouring as well. And this is a very, very interesting and mysterious process that we eventually stumbled across after looking very hard. And I'm out of time, so I'll stop there.
There's this theory of stabilizing functionals, which seems to have connections with ID factors, and so can one extend part of this to the continuum as well?
A very good question. I don't know. I mean, no reason why the definitions don't extend. I mean, it sounds like people have already looked into that. I mean, you have to decide. I mean, if you want some analog to this, you have to decide what is the system of local constraints that you want to satisfy, right? I mean, I guess you could ask for example, maximal hardcore processes is something that maximal hardcore configurations is something that springs to mind.
Yeah, that was it.
So, yeah, I don't know. Very interesting question. In the discrete setting, just for some context, let's say on Z, remember there's this intermediate category of interesting shifts of finite type on Z, so hardcore processes on Z are not in that category, of course, because if you want a hardcore process, well, one hardcore process is to just take everything zero, there are no particles, but maximal hardcore processes are, So maximal hardcore process is equivalent to colouring, sort of, in this world, in the sense that you can get between them with block factors. So yeah, maybe that's one thing to look at. But yeah.
So these stabilizing functionals are used to prove various limit theorems, like limit theorems. So can you also prove? I mean.
Yes, I think so. Yes. I mean, part of the history here is, you know, of course, people are very, very interested in proving central limit theorems and other types of limit theorems under relaxations of independence. I mean, it's a huge industry, and in particular, people have done it for k-dependent processes. And part of this history here was, okay, people really wanted to prove such limit theorems for k-dependent processes, but they couldn't, and they instead assumed that you had a block factor process, and for a while, you know, they really didn't know whether that was an additional assumption, because, you know, it wasn't known. The answer to this question wasn't known. So yeah, I mean, I don't know much about it, but yeah, people certainly do use block factor assumptions and maybe finitary factor assumptions to try to prove limit theorems.
If there are no more questions, let's thank all the morning speakers again.